Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the August-September issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The Artist's Way, from the editors. What the world needs now, besides love, sweet love, of course, is more art. Not just the stuff made by people who call themselves artists, but the self-expression of everyday folks who are working on being their authentic selves and finding their creativity, whatever kind, however rough the diamond. Don't think we're not talking to and about you. Art and creativity are for everybody, and they're in everybody. And it's not just because we're trying to draw you in our annual art issue that we're saying so. Do you cook? You're creative. Do you play an instrument? You're creative. Do you take photos? You're creative. Do you sew? Act in local theater? Sing in the choir? Plant flowers? Grow tomatoes? Read bedtime stories to children? Even just feel the nudge to get something wonderful out of you that's trapped inside? You are creative. If you need convincing and a guide to help you discover your inner artist, you might want to pick up a copy of The Artist's Way. First published in 1992, the beloved book by Julia Cameron is subtitled A Spiritual Path to Higher Creativity. If you have one of the 4 million copies sold, according to its Amazon.com page, maybe yours is well thumbed because you've come to rely on it like an encouraging friend. Or maybe it's still pristine because you've never taken the plunge. No less a creative giant than Martin Scorsese said, "This is a book that addresses a delicate and complex subject. For those who will use it, it is a valuable tool to get in touch with their own creativity." The New York Times declared, "With its gentle affirmations, inspirational quotes, fill-in-the-blank lists, and tasks, write yourself a thank you letter. Describe yourself at 80, for example. The Artist's Way proposes an egalitarian view of creativity. Everyone's got it." Elizabeth Gilbert said, "Eat, pray, love wouldn't have happened without it." And Anne Lamott said, "If you have always wanted to pursue a creative dream, this book will gently get you started." But what does Cameron say that makes her book so effective? Here are a couple of the most highlighted passages as documented by Kindle. "The quality of life is in proportion, always, to the capacity for delight. The capacity for delight is the gift of paying attention." Remember that in order to recover as an artist, you must be willing to be a bad artist. Give yourself permission to be a beginner. By being willing to be a bad artist, you have a chance to be an artist and perhaps, over time, a very good one. Here at CNI, a few of us are devotees of the book. We're the ones who are secretly singers and songwriters and guitar players who have admitted as much to each other. What or who is your secret inner artist? Do yourself and the world, which is much in need, a favor and commit to becoming the creative force you were created to be. Crime and Enchantment. With a new novel out, celebrated New Mexico crime writer Michael McGarrity talks about his work, his state, and his love for the American West. By Mark Crawford. As a former social worker and decorated cop, Michael McGarrity writes crime novels that ring truer than most, with authentic, flawed characters who are gripped by a constant emotional undercurrent and the stress of the job, lack of sleep, and the cycles of gritty hope and despair burn like a low-grade fever. The books also ring true for their Western settings and authentic observations about life and death in New Mexico. A longtime resident of Santa Fe, McGarrity routinely sets his stories in his home state. The hero in 14 of his books is Kevin Kearney, a brave and resolute police officer of unfailing integrity who toughs out his injuries to solve violent crime cases across New Mexico. The setting gives McGarrity the opportunity to eloquently describe a variety of stunning Western landscapes. It also allows for commentary on the loss of the American West to those who do not respect the land and instead sprawl across it. Cowboys and Indians recently sat down with McGarrity to talk about his writing career, the retirement of Kevin Kearney, a new novel, and the author's love of the American West. CNI. People see places like New Mexico as wild and untamed, but that definition is changing as more people leave the cities for open space. What is happening to the American West? McGarrity. People tend to have a misconception about the West. They believe it still exists, when in fact much of the land is so developed that it's hard to recognize it as the West. They believe in what they think is a Western culture, when really it's more of a Western mythology. You can put on the cowboy costume, but still be all hat and no cattle. Maybe that's okay. My wife says life is a costume party. Unfortunately, she's probably right. Your novels often reference the demise of the American West, brought on by a newer population that does not respect its history. Yes, most people in the West live in a bifurcated world of reality and mythology. They embrace a worldview that isn't urban, but it really is. Very few live outside the 21st century concrete jungle. But the land of cactus and mesas, mountains and plains, valleys and river gorges, these are the places where true Westerners work the land to maintain their livelihoods. They stay connected to it and honor this heritage, but they often feel under attack from the ever-advancing suburbia and city dwellers' misguided viewpoints about how to manage and use the land. Authentic Westerners, pilgrims or natives, understand how their family histories are connected to the land and carry a deep appreciation of the people and cultures that are part of the West. It is a real place, not a movie set or a playground or a beautiful backdrop for their lifestyles, with thousands of years of habitation and history, culture and art, tradition and spiritualism. Speaking of authenticity, you spent your boyhood growing up in the country. Tell us a bit about your Western roots. I've lived in New Mexico for 65 years. My mother was a rancher, a Montana girl. I grew up rural until my teenage years. Mom practiced tough love before it had a label. I was taught honesty and respect, to work hard, and to do as I was told. My mother's family lost the ranch during the Great Depression, and they scattered to new places to begin again. The loss forever stayed with them, and it was just too painful to discuss. Native Americans and their cultures are key parts of your books. How do you make sure your representation is accurate? I rely on primary resources. For head wounds, I studied primary source materials on the Kickapoo Nation, particularly a University of Oklahoma press publication, The Kickapoos, Lords of the Middle Border, by Errol M. Gibson. The Kickapoo originated in the upper Midwest, but were driven westward, with one band of the tribe settling in northern Mexico, where they lived virtually forgotten for 150 years. The Kickapoo are uniquely comparable to the Apache in certain ways. Both have a strong tendency to turn inward, away from the prevailing culture of today, and try to maintain their culture and traditions in the face of the modern world. Another key resource was Living Life's Circle by Claire Ferrer, who lived with the Mescalero Apache on their reservation in southern New Mexico for 15 years in the 1970s. Her work guided my description of the Apache ceremony and head wounds that celebrates the passing of the newly dead to the afterlife. I also researched the land, how it appears on the horizon, up close, far away in the distance, how it looks at sunset, in the fall, by moonlight. I study where my characters live and watch how colors and shadows shift as the sun moves or sets. I try to capture the drama and mystery of the land so it feels like the reader is actually touching it. It might surprise people that, as a writer of fiction, you read a lot of nonfiction books. What sorts of nonfiction do you enjoy? I especially like the personal and family stories that tend to be overlooked in larger-scale narrative nonfiction, but that can be even more revealing. For example, Robert Utley's Frontiersman in Blue, the United States Army and the Indian, gave me the idea for a secret stash of Army goods stolen by the Apache, which became a pivotal plot point in my first novel, Tularosa. Other favorites are Don Lobeck's Patrick J. Hurley, the life of the 19th century Oklahoman who was Hoover's Secretary of War, and Don Hoagland's Nobody's Horses, the dramatic rescue of the wild herd of the White Sands. I don't read a lot of mystery. I've written 17 books about one New Mexico family, which are known both as crime novels and historical fiction, but as a whole they constitute one family's saga over more than a century. I tend to stay away from mysteries because I don't want other writers' voices in my head when I'm working. I do not have cable or satellite TV, therefore I've not watched Longmire, Yellowstone, or Deadwood. My favorite films are Dances with Wolves, Little Big Man, and Tom Horn, which was Steve McQueen's last Western movie. How did you get started as a writer? After I got out of the U.S. Army, I was accepted at the University of New Mexico. I was surprised because I'd always been told that I wasn't very bright. As an undergraduate, I needed an easy 3-credit course and took a short story creative writing class. Knocked out 3 stories, got a good grade, and thought maybe I could be good at it someday. However, as I worked my way through college, I put that idea on the back burner. Years later, after I received my master's in clinical social work, I began writing journal articles, grant applications, and reports. I took a summer off to start working on a novel, but it wasn't easy. I had to learn a whole new craft. It took me 14 years to see my first novel, Tularosa, in print. Even though I had to go back to work during the time I was writing it, I realized that if I was to become a serious writer, I had to either keep trying or fold my hand and give up. Luckily, the decision was easy. I'm married to an absolutely wonderful woman who told me to go for it, and I did. How do you first-hand experiences in social work and law enforcement enrich your books? As a clinician and cop, I learned all the skill sets I needed to conduct successful interviews and interrogations, and also had many opportunities to use my knowledge of psychopathology. That, along with all the necessary real-world tools required to operate as a police officer and investigator, have informed my stories since the very beginning. The most gratifying compliments I received from some lawyers, prosecutors, judges, and law enforcement professionals who tell me that I got it right. You took a 10-year break from Kevin Kearney to write the sweeping 3-volume American West trilogy, Hard Country, Backlands, and The Last Ranch, which explores the history of the Kearney family through World War II. What compelled you to pursue this decade-long quest? Kearney was a mixture of modern cowboy and lawman, two strong Western traits that have an undeniable pull on me. As my protagonist's backstory in the Kevin Kearney novels evolved, I became increasingly interested in exploring his antecedents, particularly because of his strong ranching history. The trilogy is the beginning of the Kearney family saga in New Mexico, and it was a story I absolutely had to write. Vestiges of frontier life still exist on ranches throughout the West. Hard work, love for the land, fierce independence, strong family ties, loyalty to friends, and helping hand to those in need are all attributes still prevalent among the families who by choice continue to farm and ranch. Let's hope they endure and prosper. When you aren't writing, how do you spend your spare time? I read, go on dates with my bride of 60 years, play with my dog, and poke around hidden corners of New Mexico, sniffing out inspiration and story ideas. I especially enjoy working on my small plot of paradise, a few acres outside of Santa Fe, landscaping with native plants, trees, and grasses that are drought-tolerant. You once described New Mexico as one of the most sun-scorched but beautiful places on earth. Do you still feel that way? I sometimes find myself at parties in Santa Fe, mingling with the rich and famous. They often talk about the lovely time they had in Vienna or Hong Kong. They live here, but they travel often to see fantastic places around the world. For me, it's far more interesting to see all of what New Mexico has to offer. Its rich history and landscapes, historic villages, ghost towns, native culture and architecture. I've seen far more of New Mexico than I have of the world. I was once asked if I'd ever been to Paris, and I said, no, not yet. But I have been to Wild West Ghost Town and Billy the Kid Hangout, White Oaks, New Mexico. I still have not been to Paris.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, Archives, August 1979 edition. Mexico Bound. Remember the first time you left home? By Bud Goodson, as told to Eve Ball. When I rode up the Red River, it was bank full and water was running over the bridge. An armed guard was turning people back, but I rode up and told him I wanted to go to Texas and I was really on my way to Mexico, but I had to get across Texas first. Can you swim? He asked. Like a duck, I told him. If I let you cross, it will be at your own risk, he warned. I nodded and took my chaps and boots off. I tied them to the saddle and put my Colts in my hat. Then I got hold of the reins and led old Dunn onto the bridge. He didn't much want to try it, but he trusted me about as much as I did him. I went ahead, feeling for every board with my foot, and got a lucky break, for there wasn't even one missing. But the water was boiling above my knees, and I was soaked to the gizzard before we got to Texas. I waved at the guard and took off. I wasn't on the dodge, not really. Things had just gone wrong in the Choctaw Reservation where I was born, and I loved those mountains and understood how Grandma felt about them. She was a full-blooded, and in Mississippi, her folks had been rich. She had married a white man, but he was a good man, even if he was white. He was honest, and he was smart. It takes a smart one to learn to speak Choctaw, but Grandma got him talking it pretty good. It was lucky she did, because when they came to Oklahoma in the Great Removal, he interpreted for our people with the soldiers. He even talked them into letting Grandma bring a coop of chickens along. Sometimes he was sorry about that because every time the rooster would crow, she would cry for her old home, a fine house on a good farm. They had been rich folks back there and respected. Both got so they really liked the Kiamichi Mountains, and they got used to their log cabin and would have hated to leave it. Grandpa was very careful and useful to the Choctaws and the Choctaw Nation, too. He interpreted for the chiefs and was friendly with everybody. I was 15 when he died, and Grandma didn't lose much time before she followed him to the happy place. Then I got restless. I didn't hardly know why. I still had my mother and father and loved them very much. I was awful proud of them, too. We had a good, comfortable log cabin with three bedrooms and fireplaces. And Dad had some awful good cattle and the best horses in the country, racehorses. He branded A on the left shoulder, and nobody else could use his brand. One time I went to a horse race with him. There was a young man there with a filly, and she had Dad's brand. He talked to the boy. His story was that he bought the filly from his boss. She was branded when he got her. Did he have a bill of sale? No, but he'd go back and bring his boss the next day to prove his ownership. "And I'll hold the filly," Dad told him, "till you get back," which he did. And he tried her out, too. She hadn't been broke when she disappeared, but now she had been trained to run, well-trained, and was a valuable animal. When neither the boy nor his boss showed up, Dad knew that the young man's story wasn't true. The races lasted 4 days, and there was a carnival. One man with the show gave prizes for anyone who could hit a moving target with a pistol. Dad was the best shot in the county with a six-shooter, and I asked him to try it. There were many cheap prizes, but three or four pretty good ones, knives and horse blankets. Dad shook his head. "His pistol may not be accurate," he said. So I asked the man if Dad could use his own, and he consented. After Dad had hit 9 straight shots, the man asked what he'd take to quit. "Nothing," my father replied. "I don't want to break you. You have to make a living." It was only a short time later that our good leader, David Gardner, our great chief, talked with me. I'd been running around some with Jack Doolin. He was 10 years older than I was, and it pleased me to be noticed by him. What he did to make a living, I don't know, but Gardner did. He advised me not to be seen with Doolin. I'd had no suspicion of the man, but the chief was a good judge of people and had sense enough to take his advice. It was not until I heard Chief Gardner had died that I decided to leave home. Had nothing against my parents, yet, like a young bird, it was time to leave the nest. So I told them I was going. I had $4, and Dad gave me the filly and sold her for a big price, $125, and I rode away with Old Doolin. I was about 75 miles from home when I stopped after crossing Red River. I saw a little store with a corral behind it, and I thought it might be a good place to spend the night. I unsaddled, watered Dunn, and turned him into the trap where there was good grass. Then I went into the store, but there was nobody there. I was tired and hungry, so I got some cheese and a box of crackers. Then I put some money on the counter and got up on it to eat. Before I had finished, the owner came in. I showed him the money and told him about my horse being in his trap. I added that if it was all right with him, I'd sleep in my bedroll close to Dunn. "It's going to rain," he said, "and you better sleep in the store. There's a cot in the back, and you can come over to the house for breakfast." That's the kind of folks I found in Texas. They were almost like Indians. I had no trouble getting jobs as a cowhand, and I always had a good friend in Texas that was good to me, and I never made it to Mexico. True West Magazine, August 1979 edition, archived. The Eventful Day of Sam Butterworth by Ralph Lebeck. For many years, travelers following the old Spanish trail out of Mexico into the territory of Arizona would pause under a tall cottonwood. Nailed to its broad trunk was a board with an inscription which read simply, "Butterworth's Tree." It served as a warning to all who journeyed up that road. The ancient Camino Real, paralleling the course of the meandering Santa Cruz River, was the main artery to Tucson. Travelers would read the terse inscription, ready their weapons, and proceed with extreme caution. Southern Arizona in the 1860s was well known for its dangers, especially after the explosive year of 61, when Cochise, chief of the Chiricahua Apaches, declared all-out war on the whites. The rugged, broken area overflowed with roving Indians bent on trouble. A possible ambush lurked around every bend. It was definitely no place for a tenderfoot. Samuel F. Butterworth, a New Yorker, had come out west from Mississippi after serving a term as United States District Attorney. Mr. Butterworth was even a commissioned justice of the Supreme Court of that state, but gave up the distinguished honor to settle in San Francisco in 1863. In California, he was just plain Sam Butterworth, known far and wide as an honest Eastern lawyer. Since mining was the dominant interest in those days, it wasn't long before Sam Butterworth was engrossed in one little litigation after another, mostly for the big operators. As a result, he became president of the Alma Demon Quicksilver Mining Company, then went on to other mining involvements, including many in Savage, Arizona. Butterworth displayed such a natural talent for handling mining affairs that Eastern capitalists began to take notice. The fact that he was a native of New York simply bolstered the idea that here was a man whose judgment could be trusted. They made him president of the Arizona Mining Company, a company with several extensive silver holdings in the territory along the Mexican border. Since Sam Butterworth already had an interest in Arizona, and with that flattering appointment, it wasn't very difficult for the capitalists to persuade him to visit this wild region and inspect their mining properties. It was to be an enlightening trip. Butterworth disliked violence in any form. The slaughter of the Civil War had caused him to give up his prestigious life in Mississippi. Sam never did consider himself anything but a gentleman, and in San Francisco had adapted quite easily. But on the frontier, a man of his refinement was nothing more than a burden to those around him, a tenderfoot and nuisance. However, the spirit of adventure had touched Sam's soul, and in just one day he learned the hard facts of survival in that primitive world of the border country. The date was December 29, 1863. To the east, the mountains were outlined against an early morning sun. The Mexican village of Santa Cruz, just below the boundary line, was beginning to show signs of life. Three fully loaded wagons were moving out of the awakening adobe village, traveling westward. Simultaneously, two riders were loping away from the heavy wagons, heading north. The two men riding north were John Mills and Edward Stevens, both seasoned frontiersmen. Mills was manager of the Maori Silver and Lead Mine. Stevens, who had worked for the Overland Stage Route, managing men, was there to take over the mining end of the Maori. Although Mr. Butterworth wore specs and was classified as a dude in that rough area, the Eastern capitalists had guessed right when they made him president of their company. He was a tough decision maker, and Ed Stevens was his choice to run the Maori mine. It isn't quite clear when the transaction occurred, but $1.5 million exchanged hands for those diggings located about 15 miles north of Santa Cruz, just above the border. Two other men had already arrived there from the Mexican village. Guido Custel and Norman Higgins, metallurgist, had accompanied Mr. Butterworth from San Francisco by the way of Guamas. They were to inspect the mine and meet Butterworth and Tubac. The three wagons, loaded to capacity, rolled slowly over the road as they headed west. The old adobe settlement on the Santa Cruz River paid little attention. Its inhabitants were accustomed to the comings and goings of the men from the north. Señor Comodoran, the village's alcalde, alone stood on the edge of the Camino Real waving goodbye. Mills and Stevens, well acquainted with the alcalde, acknowledged the farewell by waving back till distance swallowed them up. Señor Comodoran then turned to gaze at the three crawling vehicles. A look of worry crossed his face. He guessed that they were too heavily loaded for tactical movement in case of an Apache attack. But what worried him most was they were in the hands of a tenderfoot, Also, five men from his village had been hired for protection, and he didn't trust those guards or their valor. Vaya con Dios, the owl called, whispered as he turned back to his house. The teamster of the front vehicle was an American of unknown name and origin. He had been hired at random. Sitting on the high seat with him was Sam Butterworth. Across Sam's thighs lay a fully loaded, double-barreled shotgun. On the road to the Mowry Mine, John Mills and Edward Stevens stopped at the San Antonio Mill. It was run by Thomas Yerkes and located about halfway up the route on the Arizona side of the international boundary. Yerkes was preparing breakfast out in the open. For two hungry Americans, the smell was overpowering. They spent an hour eating and visiting with Tom Yerkes. During the conversation, he told them that a band of Apaches had been seen in that vicinity. Mills was familiar with that stretch of the road, and he promised they would be careful. Riding away, the two men were relaxed. The morning was still young. An invigorating crispness was in the air. A good breakfast was under their belts. It gave them a great feeling of well-being. The course they were following led them toward the rugged Patagonia Range, known for its wildness and its treacherous canyons. There was such a canyon 3 miles before reaching the mine. Mills and Stevens were depending too much on their courage and instinct, because on that day, December 29, 1863, their instinct was somewhere else. They followed the road into the rough and narrow canyon area, and all hell broke loose. They had ridden right into a murderous Apache ambush. Edward Stevens was killed outright. John Mills drew his gun and tried to fight his way out. A desperate struggle ensued before he too went down, bristling with arrows. The Indians stripped the bodies clean and then shot them full of holes. After their debauchery was complete, they leaped on their horses and went galloping westward. A couple of teenage Mexican boys who saw the bloody act from a high cliff overlooking the canyon had made an attempt to warn the two riders, but they were too far away. When the fight was over, the boys ran to the San Antonio Mill Works and informed Tom Yerkes. Dolefully, the breathless youths reported that the white men hadn't had a chance. In the meantime, the three wagons on the Spanish Trail had rounded a bend and were now heading north. The old military road, used by Spain's soldiers in her conquest of the region, led to Tubac, a former army outpost which was now a headquarters for the Arizona Mining Company. 40 miles to the north lay the dusty, boisterous town of Tucson. The sun had reached its zenith, and the elated Apaches had halted in an arroyo between the two roads to feast on the carcasses of one of the captured horses. Sam Butterworth and the wagons had pulled up at the ancient ranch of the Santa Barbara that was now abandoned. He and his men were also having lunch. After satisfying their hunger, the Indians continued riding west, and three wagons rolled northward, heading to a point on the compass where they would inevitably meet. Mr. Butterworth was unaware of the attack on the other side of the mountain. It seemed peaceful enough on his side. He fingered the shotgun that lay across his thighs, not thinking that he might have to use it. The American driving the lead conveyance was actually a barfly picked up in Guaymas on the west coast of Mexico. But the way he was telling it on the long trip, he was not only an expert teamster, but also a great Indian fighter. The five Mexicans hired in Santa Cruz were of the same class. They had staggered out of the bars and put on a great show of bravado, merely for a little drinking money. Butterworth thought they would suit his purpose, swell the party, and give it a more formidable appearance. In any case, they were engaged only for 30 miles as far as Tubac, where the meeting was to take place with Custell and Higgins. On the second heavily loaded wagon, driven by one of five companies, rode a man by the name of Louis Janin. He was a mine expert and consulting engineer. He, too, had accompanied the Arizona Mining Company entourage from San Francisco. Sam was not yet expecting trouble, but if it did come, Janin was the one man that Sam felt could be trusted. Louis Janin didn't come to Arizona to fight Indians. but he liked and respected Sam Butterworth and would stand beside him in an emergency. Furthermore, he was not as inexperienced in the savagery of man as Sam was, so he was keeping his eyes peeled and his hands on a .44 Henry rifle. The third wagon was being driven by another one of the compadres, and on the seat beside him rode another. Of the five Mexicans, this pair appeared to be excellent horse handlers. The remaining two sat astride a couple of big-eared mules and were following in the wake of the slow-moving train. Butterworth had made a vain attempt to rent a fourth wagon, but there was none to be had in the small village. As a result, the three wagons making up the train were loaded to excess. Besides an abundant amount of medical and miscellaneous supplies, the cargo included arms and ammunition and several barrels of whiskey. In December, the country that the wagon train was passing through was magnificently beautiful. The caravan had crossed over the border and was now in the perpetual spring of southern Arizona. The Santa Cruz River flowed on the west side of the trail, and groves of cottonwood fringed the stream. The grass was luxuriant, covering the valley and hillsides as far as the eye could see with a gold-colored carpeting. The slopes of the hills and mountains were adorned with groves of oak, ash, hackberry, and various shrubs, and far in the distance were the high purple peaks of the Santa Ritas. From his seat on the front wagon, Sam Butterworth was completely taken with the splendor of the primeval scene. But Louis Jannan, riding in the second vehicle, appeared worried. The twittering of the winter birds was unmistakably missing. All that could be heard was the discordant creaking of the wheel hubs. Sam was oblivious to everything but the beautiful countryside. He reached into a side pocket of his broadcloth coat and yanked out a kerchief. He removed his spectacles, laid them in the folds of the kerchief, and wiped them free of dust to better enjoy the scenery. Unlike Jannan, Butterworth was devoid of battle instinct, but suddenly an uncanny shift took place. For no reason that could be explained, he was highly cognizant of the heavy weapon that lay across his thighs. Samuel F. Butterworth picked up the massive piece and fondled it, curling a forefinger around the trigger. While he sat contemplating the power of such a weapon, a shriek went through the peaceful air. Before the chilling reverberation ended, an Indian was standing directly in the path of the lead wagon. Butterworth's shotgun blew the Indian's head right off his shoulders. The blast rolled through those beautiful hills of golden patchwork with terrifying effect. That particular band of Apaches had never seen such a devastating hand weapon. The successful ambush of Mills and Stevens had made them overly confident. Now they were paralyzed with shock. Butterworth took advantage of the momentary lull. He ordered the wagons driven to a mesquite tree a little to the right of the road where the party could make a stand. When they were in position, Jannan passed out rifles to the rest of the men. Sam held on to the double-barreled shotgun. Then everyone crouched behind the dubious protection of the heavily loaded vehicles and waited. Butterworth was somewhat amazed at his behavior. His reaction thus far was totally contrary to his gentlemanly nature. But one thing Sam was not was a coward. He had hoped that the trip would be made without incident, but now, holding his reloaded gun, he waited for the attack with a newly acquired sense of anticipation. Both sides held their fire for a painfully long spell. Little by little, the Apaches lost their fear, and as Butterworth himself said later, they began to yell like devils. More and more arrows flew in the direction of the wagons. Slowly, the Indians came out from behind trees and protective rocks. The rifles from the little wagon train echoed through the hills as they spoke in answer. Sam's ponderous weapon rent the air with ear-splitting roars. The Indians had few firearms, but what they did have added to the din of battle. The hungover Mexicans were only wasting ammunition, but Louis Jannan found his mark several times. To what effect, it was very difficult to tell. There must have been about 30 Indians, he said after the incident, and at first, they kept their distance. After about an hour, The attackers grew bolder. Some began to creep through the tall grass toward the wagon defenses. Butterworth noticed that the slender stems were moving suspiciously. Transfixed, he waited with deadly hammers cocked until the Indians approached within 20 feet. When they suddenly arose, the whole area was filled with screams. The defenders all froze, but Sam. Again, he squeezed the triggers of his devastating piece, and its fiery pellets virtually chopped a yelling Apache in half. The assault was stopped in its tracks. Stunned silence prevailed around the wagon barrier as the scattergun's roar resounded against the canyon's walls. The Indians were swiftly retreating, not only to a safe distance, but all the way across the Santa Cruz River. Jannen confessed to Butterworth that he had not seen them coming. "Colonel," he said, "maybe if you loaned me your specs, I could do better." "No," answered Butterworth, "they wouldn't do you any good." Louis Jannen had automatically addressed Sam with the title given to men of stature in the Southwest. In his eyes, Mr. Butterworth was no longer a tenderfoot. In the meantime, four Indians had recrossed the river and were running back and forth, setting fire to the dry grass. A stiff wind was blowing, and it was in their favor. Shortly, a fierce blaze was sweeping toward the wagons, and blue smoke swirled around the freighters. At this point, Butterworth ordered the wagons moved to higher ground while they were screened from the Indians' view. Three of the Mexicans swung into the seats of the vehicles and speedily came down on the mules' rumps with leather reins. The overloaded wagons responded slowly to the straining of the animals, but with the help of the men on the ground tugging on the wheels, they made it to a small grove of cottonwood trees. There, Sam figured, on making their final stand. The position was perfect. It was open ground in every direction. They had everything in the way of supplies, food, water, and plenty of ammunition to last them for weeks or till help arrived from any quarter. The rest of the force was fast unhitching the tired mules so they could be tethered safely inside the grove. The Mexicans were communicating in their mother tongue as they loosened the sweaty harness. The American barfly understood the lingo, so he involved himself in the incessant talk. Sam did not understand Spanish and was paying little attention to their palaver until he heard one of the men from Santa Cruz yell, "Vámonos, amigos!" Instantly, Sam turned in their direction. All five of the Mexicans were riding through the cottonwoods with the American teamster and self-acclaimed Indian fighter close behind. Butterworth looked at Louis Jannen, who stood with open mouth in the center of the small grove. Last they saw of the fleeing men, they were beating their overworked mules and riding hell-bent over the nearest hill. Butterworth and Jannen stood alone now at the wagon barricade. Both of them watched as the fire engulfed the clump of mesquite where they had put up such a good fight. The unexpected desertion of the drivers at such a critical time did not go unnoticed by the watchful Apaches. Frustrated and outmaneuvered up to this point, they swiftly saw their advantage, and with smoke clouds at their backs, began to press closer to the new position. They even had Sam's fearsome weapon pretty well figured out, surmising that it was only damaging at near range. But while the marauding attackers started moving up close, but not too close, Mr. Butterworth was figuring too. He had anticipated this action. Before the Indians could surround the perimeter and lob fire arrows at them from a safe distance, he told Jannen to save himself. "I won't desert you," Jannen said, "but they're getting rather too many for us, Colonel, and I think we had both better leave." By this time, the whole battle area was enveloped in a layer of smoke. There were between 20 and 30 Indians set for the kill, yelling and shooting, and some of them chanting while slowly circling the woods. Butterworth filled his pockets with shotgun shells, then ordered Louis Jannen to get ready for their escape. Louis poured about 5 shots in rapid succession into the midst of the attackers, and partially hidden out by the smoke, the two of them sped out of the grove. Desperately, they scrambled toward a ravine 100 yards away. Those 100 yards seemed like a mile. Struggling through the grass, they had almost reached the mouth of the ravine when the alert Indians spied them. Some 10 yards short of the entrance stood a huge ash, some of its roots above ground. Each root had several growths, giving the overall appearance of many trees in one. The two men bent into a half crouch and ran rapidly toward the opening of the gully. Sam Butterworth was in his 50s, and the tremendous exertion was taking its toll. He stumbled on one of the roots, and his spectacles flew off his perspiring nose. In that flight for his life, Louis Jannen failed to see Sam fall. He didn't know that his boss was not following until he had run up the narrow ravine quite a way. Then, thinking that perhaps the colonel had run up the hill and made good his escape, Jannen kept going till dark, and eventually found his way back to the Mexican village of Santa Cruz. In the meantime, back at the scene of the action, Butterworth was unsuccessfully groping for his lost eyeglasses. He couldn't see much without them. The Indians commenced to whoop it up when it penetrated that he was alone. He became their focal point, and they cautiously began to converge. Sam Butterworth was fully aware of the gravity of his present situation. He couldn't see 2 feet without the aid of his glasses, so desperately continued his search while the Indians kept getting closer. At length, he realized that further search was futile. Picking up the fallen scattergun, resolved to make as good a fight as possible. The Indians, of course, didn't know that their quarry was now half blind, and they hesitated when a volley from the twin barrels thundered over their heads. This hesitancy gave Butterworth a chance to reload. The massive gun was leveled in their direction, and again Sam pulled the responsive triggers. The violent burst sent burning pellets over the field in a wide range. Many of the Apaches felt the sting of the searing round balls. That was enough. They turned, and in the panic, leaving Sam Butterworth momentarily master of the day. A few of the Indians set fire to the grass again, and with the blowing wind, it spread rapidly. In no time, Butterworth could feel the flames licking at him. He climbed the big ash in a mad effort to escape. The Indians buried 2 shots in the trunk, and he held them there. Back in Santa Cruz, the morning of the 30th had arrived. It was a long time coming. After an all-night vigil, every man who owned a horse and a gun was ready to ride. Señor Comandoran, the alcalde, gave the signal, and 20 armed horsemen went loping down the Camino Real. The fate of Mr. Butterworth could only be imagined. When Louis Jannen had stumbled into town the night before, worn and tired from the terrifying ordeal, he told them the attack on the caravan. The alcalde and the villagers listened in disbelief. He had blurted out that they had become separated, and Mr. Butterworth was probably now at the mercy of the Apaches. The townspeople understood the meandering. Ever since the black-robed padres long ago taught them to raise green apples, and they cultivated them with the utmost diligence, the Apaches had been a menace to their potential existence. The body of riders moved down the highway at an easy gait with Señor Comandoran in front. They didn't want to take the horses to tire. They might have a long journey ahead. The alcalde was somewhat astonished at the way Jannen and Sam Butterworth had handled himself. He had figured Sam incapable of such action. It had taken the Butterworth freight wagons a half day to get to the point of the tragic encounter. The easy-riding horsemen made it an effortless hour. They were warned of its proximity by the pall of smoke that still hung heavy in the air. With the alcalde leading the way, with holsters and scabbards, were emptied as they drew closer and fanned out. There was an ominous silence in the smoke-filled air. 2 of the wagons were standing alone near the cottonwood grove. Señor Comandoran cautiously rode over to examine them. The vehicles were empty, and their contents were scattered over a broad range. There was patent medicine bottles, broken candle boxes, cans of sardines and other foodstuff covering the ground. Practically the whole area was wrecked except for the cottonwoods. Wheel tracks of the third wagon led toward the road. The uneasy Alkaid was looking searchingly over the battlefield. There was not a sign of Butterworth. Some of the anxious men rode up to the mouth of the ravine, the avenue of Jannan's escape. Excitedly, they called the Alkaid. Four spent shotgun shells were, one by one, by the exposed roots of the tree, and not too far away lay Mr. Butterworth's spectacles. A shudder went through every man present. The apprehensive trackers followed for about 5 miles, when abruptly they spied the wagon lying on its side with the back half in the river. There was an empty whiskey barrel resting on the bank. It was obvious that it was here that the Apaches had divided the loot, then had an all-night drinking spree, and in the early morning had moved on west. There was no sign of Butterworth. The men from Santa Cruz were growing tired and were ready to turn back, but the Alkaid urged them to continue up the road a stretch. Leaving the overturned wagon where it lay, the rescue party rode another 5 miles toward Tubac. Suddenly, a thunderous roar greeted their approach, and the leaves above their heads fluttered from shotgun pellets. The whole body of riders stopped dead in their tracks. Then a loud, threatening voice from behind a mesquite tree spoke out, "Vamos!" And the Alkaid recognized it as that of Butterworth. As he attempted to get nearer, he said, "No tear, no tear, yo soy amigo." But he was answered with the clicks of a pair of hammers and saw the wicked muzzles of a shotgun pointing at him through the tree branches. In panic, the Alkaid pulled out Jannan's letter and the spectacles. Sam's big problem was, of course, that he couldn't see without those glasses. He had been wandering around all night in a sad state of blindness, but he figured that as long as he carried the shotgun, nobody was going to get near him. Now, tragically, he was ready to blast the approaching shadow, not realizing who it might be. Luckily, the Alkaid, in his moment of panic, mentioned Jannan's name when he brought out the letter. Only then did Butterworth understand, and everyone was extremely relieved, especially the good Señor Comadaran. Butterworth and his wagons were escorted back to Santa Cruz, where he was treated like a hero. Jannan was especially elated. He had remained hopeful all along that the villagers would find his employer alive. Sam Butterworth finished his tour of inspection for the company, placed Custell, Higgins, and Jannan in responsible positions, then returned to San Francisco. The incident became so well known in the young territory that when an escort of American soldiers, a month later, passed through where it took place, some of the party inscribed upon a board in bold letters, "Butterworth's Tree," and nailed it up. Yet Sam, back home in San Francisco, when friends would ask how the trip was, would merely answer, "I only had one eventful day, the rest was routine," and let it go at that. Later, when the University of California was organized, Samuel F. Butterworth was elected chairman of the Board of Regents, which was a position more to his liking and fitting to his nature. Or was it? Maybe the real Sam Butterworth was a hero besieged in an ash tree, outnumbered but never outfought.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.